First, a U.S. House of Representatives subcommittee met last week to discuss the issue of reparations for slavery.
The hearing was the second time reparations have been debated in the House, drawing some high-profile testimony from proponents like actor Danny Glover and author Ta-Nehisi Coates.
It also marks a shift in the political debate over reparations. A number of Democratic presidential hopefuls have included proposals for reparations as part of their platforms. However, some lawmakers have recently voiced opposition to the issue.
Catherine Franke is a professor of law, gender, and sexuality studies at Columbia University. She's also the author of Repair, Redeeming the Promise of Abolition. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Jay, it's so nice to be with you.
So, just to start it off, how significant is it that this House subcommittee is looking at reparations?
Well, 30 years ago, Representative John Conyers introduced a bill to study the issue of reparations and to make recommendations to Congress about how we might deliver reparations for slavery. And this is really the first time that the Congress has taken this issue up seriously. Representative Conyers, as you know, is retired from the Congress. But Representative Barbara Lee has taken it up, and it's just an incredible and very moving thing that we're having this national conversation about a history that has really never healed in this country.
So set the stage a little bit for us about, obviously this is a very broad topic, reparations, but in a very narrow, I guess, bite-sized way, what are we talking about when we talk about reparations?
Well, I think we're talking about a number of different things. And I think specifically, some people think about white people writing checks to black people. And though there, as Ta-Nehisi Coates said, there may be some checks written, really I think what we're talking about is a collective reckoning with the horror of slavery and the way in which it was never fully abolished. So that could include a transfer of money as a kind of recognition of the injury, the horror of slavery. But I also think that there deserves to be a kind of national recognition in the form of an apology for the enslavement of black people, a recognition of the ongoing forms of slavery by another name that were put in place immediately after the institution of slavery was abolished formally, and then the real historical legacy of what we left formerly enslaved people with, which was a real impoverished notion of freedom that locked them into a second-class status in this country that has had political, economic, and legal implications really since 1865.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the disparities that you mentioned, and I want to play a piece of testimony from Ta-Nehisi Coates. He has written about the case for reparations in the past and was one of the people who testified last week about this. Here is Ta-Nehisi Coates.
The typical black family in this country has one-tenth the wealth of the typical white family. Black women die in childbirth at four times the rate of white women. And there is, of course, the shame of this land of the free, boasting the largest prison population on the planet, of which the descendants of the enslaved make up the largest share. The matter of reparations is one of making amends and direct redress, but it is also a question of citizenship. In H.R. 40, this body has a chance to both make good on its 2009 apology for enslavement and reject fair-weather patriotism. To say that a nation is both its credits and its debits.
So really, in short here, what Ta-Nehisi Coates is testifying about is, once again, those disparities that we just, you know, mentioned a minute ago. But it also brings the conversation of reparations and slavery into more present day ways of considering, you know, how this has had, you know, a ripple effect through our own history. When you hear testimony like that, you know, how do you think that resonates with people who are, you know, tuning into this conversation, maybe even for the first time?
Well, I think for a lot of people, this is a somewhat new issue. And I think the issue of slavery is one where we studied in middle school and we're told that we fought a civil war over it. And then we passed the 13th Amendment and ended slavery. And that was all there was to tell about it. And what we're starting to hear from people like Ta-Nehisi Coates, but from others who've been at this work for a very long time, is a much more complicated story. And I think what's significant about this issue coming up in the Congress, but also among almost all of the Democratic candidates for the presidency, is an enriched national conversation about the legacy of slavery and how we're still living with it today in a numerous way. So it's nice to see this issue break out into the open, and for those of us who've been working on it a long time, these are familiar facts. It's a familiar set of concerns about a national legacy of slavery. But for some folks, it's new news. It's a new way of thinking about racism and white supremacy, and we have to keep talking about it and deepen the conversation to bring those who are new to it along in this struggle.
We're talking to Catherine Franke right now. She is a professor at Columbia Law School, and she's the author of Repair, Redeeming the Promise of Abolition. And she's with us to talk about this growing conversation about reparations, which is either through money or resource redistribution, a way to narrow the gap and basically address slavery in a way that we haven't really in this country so far. And, you know, the day ahead of this testimony, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was asked whether or not he supported reparations. So again, for our listeners, this was before the testimony started, and this is what he had to say.
I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us currently living are responsible, is a good idea. We've tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We elected an African-American president. I think we're always a work in progress in this country, but no one currently alive was responsible for that.
Again, that was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and that was his answer when he was asked about whether or not he supported reparations. You know, where does his line of thinking fall into what some people have thought about reparations previously?
Well, it's interesting that he would say that there is no relevance to this discussion today since slavery formally ended 150 years ago, just as we're going into celebrating the 4th of July. So there are countless ways in which we annually come together and celebrate moments from our past, see those moments as really formative for who we are as a people today. You know, there are no baseball games that begin without us standing up and saying the Pledge of Allegiance and honoring our nation's history. And so there's some history that we're happy to hold on to, and there's other history that we choose to forget. And part of what this national conversation today is that our national history is complicated for better and for worse. And it's that hard part, the worst part, that the reparations discussion is trying to bring back out into the open so that the history of slavery doesn't remain just a dead fact in the past, becomes a more active part of our current memory.
We're talking to Catherine Franke of Columbia Law School about reparations for descendants of slaves, and that is after a House subcommittee invited testimony on the issue last week.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of reparations for descendants of slavery? Do you think that this is the right way to address economic disparities in the African-American community? Do you have questions about how a reparations program would work? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. We're continuing our conversation about reparations, the political debate over them, and what a possible reparations program could look like. Catherine Franke of the Columbia Law School is our guest.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about reparations? Would you support a reparations program? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Catherine, we talked about the fact that this call for reparations it's not coming from nowhere. There's actually a fair amount of historical precedent for this. Can you talk a little bit about the debate over reparations and what they look like right after the Civil War?
Absolutely. And then so much that I think is important about the current discussion around reparations is knowing this history. So as the Northern military moved through the South, taking occupation or occupying various areas in the Confederacy, there are a couple of places in particular, the Sea Islands in South Carolina and several plantations outside Vicksburg, Mississippi, where Northern military leaders saw the state of the enslaved people as they fled the plantations to safety of the Northern military units. These people were poor, they were hungry, they'd been whipped, so they were scarred. They were just emotionally devastated from the violence of slavery. And what the Northern military officials instantly recognized is something was owed to freed people more than mere emancipation. You know, absolutely we should abolish the institution of slavery and free the slaves, but we needed to do more than that. And they all, these Northern military officials, were convinced that reparations, and they use that term, reparations, were owed to freed people, both to recognize retroactively the horror, the death, the torture, the separation of families, the rape that slavery was about, but also prospectively for freedom to actually have any meaning, people needed material resources. You know, the freed people were illiterate. They couldn't read or write because it was illegal to teach them to read or write when they were enslaved. They had absolutely no money. And so what the military officials said is that these people actually have a mortgage on the land, a moral mortgage on the land that is owed to them as reparations. And this is where we get this idea of 40 acres and a mule, is that land was allocated to freed people as reparations at the immediate end of the Civil War, and all that land was stolen from them when President Lincoln was assassinated and the new president, Andrew Johnson, restored property rights to the former slave owners. And so we had a very short period during the middle to the end of the Civil War where black people were actually given reparations as a moral imperative, and that ended with Lincoln's death. And that wound, that ongoing wound, we're still living with.
So given the fact that, you know, basically the reparations lasted for an extremely short amount of time, were there any other politicians at the time that picked up the mantle, or was it just sort of left to fade away?
There were a few politicians who continued to introduce in Congress and in public discussion and in the media the idea of an ongoing obligation to repair the horror of slavery, and of course that there were African-American people themselves. Frederick Douglass talked about it. A number of African-American leaders talked about reparations, and there were efforts to deliver both financial and land-based repair to formerly enslaved people, but none of those efforts actually succeeded.
So I want to go to our callers right now. We have Lynn in Ellison Bay. Hi, Lynn. What did you want to say?
Hi there. How are you?
I'm well. What's your question or comment?
Well, I was wondering, I never hear anything about the economic impact of reparations, and I'm wondering if there wouldn't be a huge positive economic impact, much more per se than tax cuts and things, in the sense that it would directly put money to the into areas where it's needed.
And Lynn, thank you so much for that call. And so Lynn gets to this point about investment sort of versus just a tax cut. What would a more active investment in terms of reparations look like in communities that are a little harder hit?
Well, one of the things that I recommend in Repair, the book on reparations that just came out, is that we use the estate tax as a way to find the money to pay for reparations. My generation of people in their 50s, 60s are standing to inherit huge sums of money. It's actually the largest intergenerational transfer of wealth we've ever seen in humankind. And this is taking place right now as the great generation passes away and passes on their family fortunes to their kids. And much of those fortunes were accumulated through the ownership of land, a deal that black people never got in on. So the estate taxes are very, very low right now. We could raise those estate taxes and basically recoup what is, I feel, money that was held in trust for formerly enslaved people, and then use that money for collective remedies in the black community. I'm not as keen on writing individual checks only to people who can show a genetic descendants from enslaved people, but instead those black people in our society who have suffered from white supremacy and from the racism that is its expression could be collectively the beneficiaries of a number of measures, including community land trusts, which are this really creative way of bringing land and home ownership into community control. So there are a number of interesting experiments going on or being discussed about how we might move money into the black community to empower it rather than to just write checks to individual black people.
And those other potentials, how much have those been actually discussed? Because when we frequently hear about reparations, it's just that, cut a check and give it away. But that's not exactly what many people are looking for, right?
Well, there's been a very rich discussion about reparations might look like. You know, if you look at the South African example or other places around the world where we've engaged in discussions about reparations more recently, many different means of repair have been used. And so those conversations have happened in the United States, but among a very small number of people, and a lot of very creative thinking has gone into what reparations might look like. And that's why passage of this bill in Congress is so important, where those ideas can be debated and considered and recommendations can be made to Congress that are much more complicated than some of the more simple things that we've heard circulate in the media more recently.
I want to go back to our callers right now. We have Grace in Bayfield. Hi, Grace.
Hi, this is Grace. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate this topic. I strongly want to support reparations. And I'm sorry, the reason I called is I care for my mother, and she's elderly, and she can't really talk well on the phone. But she said to me, so what are we going to do with reparations for the Native Americans?
And Grace, thank you so much for that call. Catherine, that is a comment that we have seen a lot today, too, which is people who want to support reparations, but they see all of the other injustices in our own history, in particular for Indigenous communities. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Grace, that is such an important thing to raise. And it came to my mind several times during the hearings on the bill in Congress last week. Because so often you hear people say that slavery was America's original sin, but of course it wasn't. It was the conquest and genocide and violence and dispossession of Native Americans, you know, toward the Native Americans by European settlers that was our original sin. And that's not to diminish in any way the violence of slavery, but this country was founded on a number of forms of violence, slavery and the dispossession or treatment of Native Americans, both being, I think, primarily important. So I have actually been working with several Native American leaders in the Northeast on this issue, and I think the issue of reparations looks quite different for Native people than it does for African Americans. I think sovereignty, you know, recognizing Native people as sovereign nations is part of what we need to do to repair the injury of conquest when Europeans settled in the U.S. or in North America. And so our reparations for slavery may look a little bit differently. But, you know, we're smart people, all of us in this country. We can have two discussions at the same time. The one need not happen in a way that somehow eclipses the need to address both issues.
Yeah, and it sort of goes back to what Ta-Nehisi Coates said in his testimony, that we are a nation of our credits and our debits, and that we can recognize a lot of things at once as part of the, you know, the growing part of our fabric of our country. Now, part of why we're talking about this is because, you know, we are just about a year away from the next presidential campaign. A lot of Democratic candidates have said, I support reparations. This is something we should do. Are you surprised to see that?
Well, I'm a little surprised to have seen it taken off as much as it has, because a year ago, no one was talking, or very few people in our national political culture were talking about the issue. And I think part of why we're seeing a difference is that we have people of color who are prominent politicians, who are reflecting the demands of their constituencies, to be sure. But we also have one of the most frank and ugly racists in our political history in the White House. And I think that there is, this is not to say that we have not had white supremacy or racism in our political culture before, but there are ways in which Donald Trump expresses white supremacy and racism that is more frank and more ugly than anyone we've seen before occupying that office. And I think it's made the need for a form of national repair all the more pressing while we have politicians from the Democratic Party actually getting quite detailed about what we ought to do.
In the last 30 seconds, how do you expect to see this conversation continue?
Well, we'll have there'll be a process in the Congress where this bill will get voted out of committee and then go to the full House, and I imagine it will pass the House. And then we'll have an issue in the Senate where we have a Republican Senate that may not bring it up. But the presidential campaigns will be addressing it more and more specifically, and I think generating a more a deeper national conversation about that form of repair for this ongoing historical wound.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Catherine Franke, the Sulzbacher Professor of Law and Gender and Sexuality Studies at Columbia University. She was with us today to discuss the political fight over reparations for descendants of slavery and how that discussion has changed throughout history. You can keep that conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page.